Naturally occurring black pigments in vegetables, spices, and seeds have been found to have powerful anti-inflammatory effects. Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and I'm excited about what I think may be the next big thing in anti-inflammatory supplements, a brand new, all-natural daily preventative against a host of possible inflammatory issues. Black for Health, liquid extract from Future Farm Botanicals. Black for Health combines four plant-based foods, black garlic, black radish root, black cumin seed, and black peppercorn, containing high levels of body-ready healing botanicals. Black for Health supports your liver, skin, cholesterol, blood pressure, and weight management, circulation, and immunity. It's a tasty supplement with liposome complex for optimal absorption. For more information or to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's myfuture. Farm, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly session in which we answer your questions. Questions can come to us via radio program at AOL.com. And we welcome questions related to the theme of intelligent medicine that pretty much covers the ground between high-tech medicine, natural interventions. We talk diet. We talk lifestyle. We cover the gamut. I'm with Layla Mudin, who's our nutritionist in residence. Okay, Layla, what's our next question?
Okay, we've got an email from Alice. Alice is asking about supplements. How many are too many for an elder female, not terribly active, due to pain?
And this question recounts the famous line from the poem, how do I love thee? Let me count the ways.
Right.
You know, it's
Elizabeth Barrett Browning, right?
Elizabeth Barrett, thank you. You're very erudite. Yes.
I'm a poet, don't you know it?
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry.
By that I mean, you know, is there a set threshold for each person to how many supplements they can take or should take? And, you know, let's look, I mean, what are some of the possibilities? You say you're elderly. What was the age of this person who claims they're elderly?
Didn't say.
Okay. Okay. So
just elder female.
So in older people, they may have limitations to their swallowing ability, to their digestive ability. They may have limitations in terms of their kidney function and liver function. So it is sometimes a good idea, just as with medications, to, you know, limit the number of medications that people take as they get older and maybe reduce the dosages to, you know, kind of take a critical look at the supplements because, you know, if they're superfluous or if they're kind of competing with the detox pathways in their liver or kidney for processing, you know, maybe it's time to step back. But we kind of do that on an individual basis, you know, based on people's underlying health problems. We can look at blood tests. We can see if there's liver problems. We can see if there's kidney limitation in kidney function. And then, of course, you know, we talk to people like, well, how does it feel when you take, 16 different supplements? So you feel like you're choking? Do you feel like you're having difficulty swallowing? Are you getting diarrhea, indigestion? I mean, take it from there, Layla. What are some of the other considerations?
Because Alice, she's elderly and not terribly active because of pain, the other thing we would do is we would prioritize the supplements that may help her with pain.
Yeah.
It could be something like CBD. It could be enzymes. It could be anti-inflammatory supplements like curcumin and, and boswellia and fish oil, things like that.
Yeah.
And we would prioritize those to help her manage her pain possibly and see what else. Maybe there are other deficiencies that may be the cause of her pain. We don't know the cause of pain.
You know, there is, and this has been in the literature back and forth, is vitamin D, is it related to the pain threshold? And there is some literature that suggests that people may be more achy when they're vitamin D deficient.
That it is associated with pain syndromes, a low vitamin D.
And if the pain is related to spasm, then we consider magnesium But not all pain is related to spasms. People like have a lot of, you know, like oh, I'm getting Charlie horses, I'm getting cramps, I'm getting back spasm. Then we might say, ooh, you know, could this person be magnesium deficient, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, we also think of the status of the brain, you know, the brain being the sort of the control tower for receiving pain signals. And do we want to support brain function? Because, you know, it's thought, you know, the expression, it's all in your head. Well, it may be.
Yeah.
I mean, at least partially, you know, that.
And we also have to take into account, do a real good review of how any prescription medications may be impacting their nutrition status.
Yep. Yep.
Especially adversely impacting their nutrition status, you know, certain hormones or metformin, other medications can deplete B12, can deplete folate.
Mm-hmm.
Certain other things can deplete vitamin C. Mm-hmm. Certain other medications like the corticosteroids and maybe anticonvulsants can deplete vitamin D. We have to look at all that.
Right. And and when it comes to another type of pain, which is neuropathic pain or nerve pain, you know, the B vitamins may play an important role.
Yeah.
You know, B6, alpha lipoic acid B1. For neuropathic pain,
B12.
Thiamine, B1, and certainly B12. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, pain is a very complicated phenomenon. And I'm not going to claim that vitamins and supplements are a panacea for all types of pain, but they can, in some cases, be an important adjunct to pain management.
Yeah. So to Alice's question of how many are too many for an elderly female, it's hard to say because first we need to take a look at you and see if there are any deficiencies.
Mm-hmm.
Or anything else for that matter, you know, all of your systems and so forth. So it's not, there's no magic number of don't take more than 28 pills
right.
a day.
Exactly.
Right.
Although that may not be a bad threshold right there, which you just mentioned.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is a perfect segue to, you know, what we're going to talk about next, which is we're going to invite one of our sponsors to share an important message for Alice about yet another supplement that she might consider to.
Ah.
No, I'm just kidding. Maybe this. This may or may not be suitable for Alice, but for the rest of you, please listen up. This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by ProPax with NT Factor, a complete vitamin and mineral formula. NT Factor is the only nutritional formula clinically proven to reduce fatigue, whatever the cause, whether it be age, illness, or just being run down. NT Factor repairs damaged cells, restores healthy bacteria in your digestive tract. Clinical trials have shown NT Factor reduces fatigue by almost half, and it even reverses some symptoms of aging. I've been taking NT Factor for years, and now the 45-day money-back guarantee, you have nothing to lose. To order, call 800-982-9158, that's 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com, that's ntfactor.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing, free resource to you. And now, back to our questions with Layla. What's our next question, Layla? Tee it up.
We have an email from Mark. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I'm a 75-year-old male in good health. He gives us his cholesterol numbers and vitamin D's and his blood pressure, all of which are pretty good. He has a zero calcium score. He's on no prescription medications.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, who is 75 years old.
Oh, congratulations. Great. I mean, that's really an outlier. You know, somebody 75 who's on no prescription medications.
And yeah.
Also, a bit of an outlier in the sense that he's a male who at 75 has no plaque. That's something I aspire to. You know, at 65, I determined I had no plaque. Maybe I'll check in again at 75 to make sure that no plaque has developed.
There you go. My cardiologist is not pushing me to take a statin to reduce my LDL, which is a 99.
That's unusual. That's when you know,
goes on to say,
but
he routinely,
Here's the big
He routinely performs a carotid duplex scan to monitor plaque in my carotid arteries. And they currently show less than 50% stenosis. But he tells me
That less than 50% stenosis, that means there's some plaque there? Is that mean is I
there is, but it's less than 50.
Well, okay, this is a little unusual because there's usually a concordance between plaque in the coronary arteries and plaque in the carotid arteries. So there's sort of discordance because he says he has zero in his coronary arteries.
Yes.
But he has some in his carotid arteries.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So his cardiologist says, if my carotid plaque goes above 50% in the future, then he would want me to take a statin. Yeah. I don't want to take a statin. Mm-hmm. What can I do or take to reduce or control this carotid plaque? How about natokinase?
Yeah, this sounds exactly like a medical consult that, you know, we might have somebody come into our office presenting us with that kind of dilemma. And, you know, we would take a lot of time to determine, you know, what are their risk factors? And, you know, there's so many, you know, including obviously, you know, your exercise level and your weight and your body mm-hmm. fat percentage and your blood sugar and, you know, the rest. I mean, it's kind
of your smoking status.
You know, I sound like Joe Biden. You know, the thing, you know, it's the rest.
Yes, the thing.
Right. Come on, man. But so what I mean is, is the cholesterol and HDL and apolipoprotein A and B and, you know,
the
particle size and homocysteine, LP little a. I don't mean to make it, you know, sound esoteric and, you know, very complicated, but it is. And I'll tell you, just to give you an idea of the complexity of this, I'm doing some preliminary talking, you know, to a very innovative group of researchers who put together via machine learning and artificial intelligence a new way to assess cardiovascular risk. And what they did is they fed all this data, not just the few things I mentioned, but literally hundreds of different what are called the components of the metabolome, which are, you know, all the different chemicals that the body makes. And, you know, just to screen to see if they had any relevance to cholesterol, I mean, to a cardiovascular risk, ultimate risk of heart disease. And the machine learns because they quiz the machine. They say, well, you know, guess whether this person has cardiovascular disease. And then they reveal whether the person has cardiovascular disease, and it's either they do or they don't, or to some degree or another. And then the machine learns, like, okay, like that wasn't right, so let me get it right. And after literally hundreds, thousands of iterations, the machine learns to understand a pattern. Now, what's interesting about that pattern may consist of so many things that a human can't keep track of them, but the machine has an infinite capacity to keep track of things, almost infinite, because of computing power. And what they actually came up with is that there were four major things that, when looked at in combination, are determinants of cardiovascular risk. And what's interesting is, I said, well, so what are they? You know, is it HDL? Is it homocysteine? No, he said, it's none of the things that you know. And then they rattled off some chemicals that I'd barely heard of, you know, maybe I'd read about them in organic chemistry and, you know, or in physiology in med school, but, you know, things that you wouldn't suspect. So what that means, I mean, we've got to, you know, this may not be ready for prime time yet, but the implication is that there may be some undiscovered things out there, like new planets in the solar system or new stars in the sky that we haven't yet developed the discernment to understand, that may be the determinants of cardiovascular risk. Just to give you an example, I mean, saw a couple of husband and a wife today, you know, because we've been doing telemedicine today from a home studio and my home office. And one has a fairly high degree of plaque, the husband, and the wife has no plaque. And they actually have virtually identical cholesterols. Their cholesterol is virtually identical. So, you know, how do you explain that? It's just not about cholesterol.
Well, that's how men and women are different.
But men, hey, guess what? But what ineffable thing is it about women that somewhat protects them, but not always, from cardiovascular disease? And so, you know, we may yet need to discover that. But anyway, I digress, as I want to do. And so with the answer to this guy's question is, you know, we'd like to find out what is it that's predisposing his carotid arteries to plaque. Does he have borderline hypertension? I mean, I guess the cardiologist isn't
concerned about it. No, it's 100 over 68.
Oh, perfect. Okay. Yeah.
And he has a triglyceride level of 50 and an HDL of 88.
Okay. So let's presume...
Everything's good.
Let's presume that cholesterol is the culprit, but that's not necessarily the case.
Right.
You know, because cholesterol lowering may or may not have an impact on his progression of carotid artery disease. But if we wanted to...
But it's like you said earlier, Dr. Hoffman, you know, we need to look at lipoprotein little a.
Yeah, yeah.
We need to look at oxidized LDL. Yeah. LDL is a 99, but...
Yep. So, but one of my favorite things to use...
These may be bigger tellers.
And we use these quite often as an alternative to statins in some cases. Not, I mean, I look, I'm not against statins. I prescribe them from time to time. And, you know, in people who have high risk, people have low risk, it's a waste of time. But bergamot would be one thing.
Yes.
Just if you really hate to take a drug, you can take red yeast rice, although actually I prefer if you really need a statin, take a statin, not red yeast rice, in my opinion. And then take all the other things that are preventive. Take aged garlic extract, you know, chiolic aged garlic extract.
Yes, chiolic.
2,400 milligrams per day. Take resveratrol.
Yes.
I do like pycnogenol for circulatory. We talked about pycnogenol in the first segment. Mm-hmm. You know,
fish oil.
And actually, demonstrably, fish oil has been shown to have preventive benefits against coronary artery disease. So, you know, that would be part of the program. Vitamin K2.
Right.
Yeah. Vitamin K2,
MK7. What do you think of natokinase? Mark is asking specifically about natokinase. What do you think,
Natokinase is more, it's not so much for preventing plaque, it's for preventing blood clots. And I'm not entirely sure he's at risk for blood clots. But it is a stroke preventive. You know, it's the kind of thing that we might use in somebody who's had blood clots before or is evidenced some susceptibility of blood clots or is high risk, has a lot of blockage. He doesn't have that much blockage, but, you know. So, I mean, look, I respect the cardiologist's cautious approach. I mean, the cardiologist knows he's dealing with a guy who's not anxious to take statins, but the cardiologist wants to protect the guy. So he's saying, you know, let's make a deal. I mean, we'll keep monitoring you. And, you know, if it reaches a certain threshold and your natural measures don't pay off, then, you know, we'll have to pull the trigger on the statins.
Right. Right. Okay. Best of luck to you, Mark. Good health to you. We have a very interesting email from Nicole, Dr. Hoffman. She asks, do you happen to know how to go about notifying that a person does not want a blood transfusion? For example, in a medical emergency situation, how would the doctors know you refuse blood transfusion if you are unable to communicate?
Well, there is a model for that, and that model is based on a religion, which is Jehovah's Witness religion, does not allow its members to receive blood transfusions. And so, you know, you might check a website where they provide information to their constituency about how to notify the authorities, your preference. You know, when people fill out medical forms in doctor's offices, you can specify that. You can also get an alert bracelet, you know, that says that you don't want a blood transfusion. Now, the question is, why does this person not want a blood transfusion?
She doesn't say.
Okay. I mean, I get it. Maybe there's like vegetarians. I mean, they don't want, you know, it's for ideological reasons. And certainly it's for religious reasons that a Seventh-day Adventist doesn't want. I'm sorry, that a Jehovah's Witness doesn't want
Jehovah's Witness. Yeah.
But, you know, rationally speaking, I mean, blood transfusion can be problematic. They can transmit disease. They can also create reactions of various kinds.
Oh, but how often does that happen? How often does that happen?
It happens relatively uncommonly, but I'll tell you this, is that when I broke my leg, my blood counts were at a very low level, you know, between the bleeding that occurred when I broke my leg internally, because it didn't break the surface, but my whole leg was swollen and purplish. And the surgery, I had half the blood volume that a normal person has. And, what they said is that often, I was near the threshold where they would give me a blood transfusion, but because I was a healthy individual and because I didn't really need it, it wasn't a true emergency, they didn't put, they're reluctant to put extraneous blood because there's a slight chance of some transmitting an infection, although they screen blood very carefully. But, there's sort of an ick factor of getting blood from another person, obviously. I would not see if, I would counsel this person to reconsider that, is that, you might express the opinion to your primary care doctor that you would have a very, very high threshold for getting a blood transfusion. But, if it's a life-saving thing, you might consider a blood transfusion. Now, what do you do for Jehovah's Witnesses? They have these amazing techniques now of blood recovery, during surgery where they kind of capture your blood and they recirculate it back into you. There's some institutions that specialize in that. So the Jehovah's Witnesses often go to these institutions when they get their surgery because they realize that those are not places to transfuse, casually or lightly.
Yeah.
The other thing you can do is if this is a concern of yours, is donate blood and bank it so that if in an emergency you've got blood that's your own blood. And you can designate it for that purpose. Now, the only problem is it's only good for a certain period of time. It's not good forever. So if you could ask if that's permissible, that's another way to deal with it. But I wouldn't make it. Look, I mean, if it's a question of life and death, like God forbid, like that woman who got hit by the car, it's like out of the blue, some horrendous calamity can hit.
Yeah.
And you might need the blood.
Yeah.
And then, you're going to sacrifice your life because of a preference? I mean, let's be pragmatic about it.
Yes. Agree.
I mean, unless it's your religious...
Of course, it should be anybody's personal decision.
Yeah, I mean, if it's religion, an example, is Jews are prohibited from eating pork. But, when young Jewish children... faced either death or the potential for survival when they first invented insulin that was pork insulin, all the rabbinical authorities agreed that what superseded the religious prohibition against pork was the sanctity of life and survival. So they said, let's prioritize life over a religious preference. And they allowed people to get that to survive. Okay. Anyway, that's an interesting question. I never had that question in my entire span of my career.
Yeah. Okay, and I thought we were going to be able to get away from the subject, but we have our final question,
is
Dr. Hoffman.
COVID.
Is about COVID.
No kidding.
How to avoid anxiety about COVID?
Yeah.
People are fearful. Yeah, people are fearful of dying if they get COVID. So when they get tested and before they're given results or shortly after they call the ambulance to take them to the ER and then they need someone non-COVID to drive them home, exposing a lot more people to COVID.
Right.
So there's more exposure going on this way.
How
can we talk to people about the anxiety around COVID and what not to do?
There's a
whole podcast.
There's sort of a fine line between, encouraging people to take a sort of a resilient approach to a pandemic and minimizing the pandemic, like being in COVID-19 denialism, or taking sort of a let it rip mentality, like, let it run its course, we're all going to, most of us won't die anyway, so this is sort of what we've been talking about. I mean, it's been sort of the whole theme of many of our broadcasts is how to put this in proper context. Yes, it is dangerous. What are some of the things to do? I mean, in the beginning of this, and still to this day, we have people who are afraid to leave their apartments. They leave their groceries out on the front stoop or, in the hallway for a few days to let the virus die down. Then they spray down and swab the, things with gloves. And they're literally germ phobic.
Don't eat that spoiled food if it's been out there a few days, folks.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, non-perishable goods. You know, hopefully it's not like, you know, I ordered a pizza and I wanted to let it, you know, sit for a few days, you know.
Got to let out, stay out there for 3 days.
right. So, anyway. Yeah.
And, you know, staying indoor and exposing yourself to all that disinfectant is a whole other matter.
Yeah.
That's a lot of toxicity right there.
Just a, it's such a broad topic. And, you know, I hope that some of, I'm not going to answer it in its entirety during this segment, but this is always a theme on my intelligent medicine broadcast is how to properly contextualize this, how to steer a course between utter, you know, paranoia and proper prudence. And that's, I think, the art of this. But here's an interesting article. Every month delayed in cancer treatment can raise risk of death by around 10%. So this is something that is very relevant right now because there are people who are delaying going to the doctor and they're delaying routine screening. It's happening all the time.
Yeah.
And so this is just one area is cancer. Every month delayed in cancer treatment can raise risk of death by around 10%. So, you know, not that cancer, some people are going to scoff and they're going to say, well, cancer treatment is often inefficacious. True, but it sometimes is. And on average, the delays can create problems.
True. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's many other, other things like, you know, the level of, you know, what loneliness does, what isolation does, you know, the effects of lack of exercise, et cetera. I mean, there's some real collateral damage that COVID-19 is causing without actually giving us COVID-19.
True. We will find out years into our future.
Yeah.
The total impact of the lockdown versus COVID-19.
But, you know, some measures that people can take is that don't be incessantly glued to the TV because the TV has, you know, dual agendas.
They'll scare you to death.
Yeah. I mean, there's a negativity bias on TV. And negativity bias means that, you know, what bleeds leads. And, you know, if you watch TV and you live in an urban area, you'd think that every moment somebody's being, you know, murdered, strangled, you know, run over. In a city of, you know, there are 8 million people in Naked City. And, you know, if 6 of them come to harm on a Saturday night, you're going to hear about it on the evening news. And similarly, with COVID-19, the vast majority of us are unaffected. We're majorly inconvenienced. But also, there's a negativity bias by doctors. You know, doctors talk negative about health. That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to be disease finders and disease hunters. They're not there to, you know, in fact, doctors are at risk if they just, you know, have great bedside manner and say, oh, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. It's going to, you know, how many times will you be sued for malpractice if you ignore patients' complaints and it turns out to really be something? So doctors, you know, people are going to say, well, I have really bad headaches. Oh, let's do an MRI to see if you have a brain tumor. Well, very unlikely to have a brain, but you better check for, I mean, maybe you have an aneurysm. I mean, occasionally it turns out that way. But, you know, that's going to be scary at first. And that's how doctors operate and how they're trained. And that's also how some of the major health authorities who you're hearing, you know, the talking heads in the white suits, I mean, in the white coats, are approaching this pandemic. They're approaching it from a medical perspective, which is their job, but they're going to accentuate the perils of it because that's in their wheelhouse, you know, and they're not... they're not so much concerned with the economic consequences or the psychological consequences of that. They're disease hunters. So anyway, that's part of the problem. But, you know, right. I take that question as sort of a comment. And, you know, I mean, what do you do when you get COVID-19?
Yes.
You know, you put on a really good, if you get a positive test, put on a really good N95 mask. If you need somebody to take you, they should be masked up. They should then be tested to see if it's been transmitted. All the contacts need to be tested. It's a real pain in the you know what. But, you know, the other day, I mean, I was on my street. There's an urgent care. And this is when the weather was still nice. Where all these people like lined up to get into the urgent care. And I said, oh, my God, you know, my first thought was, all these people sick and they're going to the urgent care. And then I realized that there's a lot of those people are getting tested because they may have had contact. They're simply getting tested, or else they may be required by their jobs to get tested, or they may be trying to travel to a place that requires documentation of testing. And so they don't necessarily all have to be sick. I mean, I was aghast at first. I was like, oh my God, look at all these sick people lined up to go to urgent care. But, you know, they looked fairly comfortable. It didn't look like they were collapsing on the sidewalk. Yeah. So that's one of the consequences.
And all this testing is encouraged elsewhere. So, yeah. There is that too.
Yeah. So, folks, we're going to get through this. You know, it's a bit of an ordeal. I mean, other people have, you know, other generations have gone through worse and more painful ordeals. You know, thank God.
Yes, they've slayed bigger dragons.
Yes. But this is our current bête noire, to maintain the metaphor. And we're dealing with it. All right. So thank you for joining us. Keep sending questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. And we'll be there for you next week to answer it. Thank you, Layla.
That's right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
Okay. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
This is Layla Mutin, RD. I see patients regularly, along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.